Hi folks, welcome to episode 73 of the Epochs of the Lotus Eaters. I am, as always, joined by Beau, and today we're going to be talking about William the Bastard. I refuse to call him William the Conqueror this early on, because he's not conquered anything at this point. He's just a bastard, some bastard Norman Duke. I mean that in a literal sense, I'm not just insulting him. He's an illegitimate son, is he not?
No, absolutely, yeah. His mother wasn't married to his father, and she was a nobody, absolute nobody. Yeah. Well, just very
quickly. She
was obviously
just a babe.
Yeah, yeah. Her laver, Falaise, that was her name. Apparently, she was absolutely beautiful, because like a duke can pick anyone, sort of, within reason. Yeah. Just very quickly to say on his name then, the Conqueror was given to him long after, like a lot of people, like Hardrada and like the Confessor. During his time, his detractors called him the Bastard. But at the time, or certainly after the conquest, he was known as William the Great.
Hmm.
And so anyway, it's only after the fact that we call him the Conqueror.
Hmm.
So again, just to sort of set the scene, as I often do, just to mention the sources before we sort of get into it. There's quite a lot of, obviously, French sources. Once the actual conquest and invasion starts, he shows up in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. But other than that, we've got a Ralph Glabert, William of Jumièges. I've mentioned William of Jumièges. Mm-hmm. He's sort of one of the big ones. There's Aldric Vitalis writing quite a long time after, 100 odd years or more after. Robert Wace, Master Wace, is one of the big ones, actually. But there's others. William of Malmesbury, Henry of Huntingdon, same sort of names. We've got Adam of Bremen. There's a poem that was found in the 19th century that's colloquially known as the Carmen, only about an 800-line poem. But that gives us some details we didn't have before. Right, it's funny how things can turn up, quite literally turn up, like a new manuscript of Tacitus turned up.
Well, the Dead Sea Scrolls just
Great example. Yeah, absolutely great example. One of the biggest ones is a William of Poitiers, who is completely contemporary. He was around at the time. Hmm. He was actually there and saw all these things with his own eyeballs.
Yeah, because so just as a brief thing, you'd think that chroniclers would have been more common, right? Like, Harold Hardrada, why didn't he have a chronicler? Like, okay, look, I'm going to undertake a great invasion of England. I'll just bring one guy who's going to write down what happened. You'd think that would be really common. I mean, like, there is one for the Crusades, isn't there? The unknown chronicler on the Crusades. But generally, it's not that common. And it's kind of weird because, like, well, I want an eyewitness account, surely, you know?
It's not as common as we would like.
No,
one slight thing to say there is maybe the ones that survive. There may have been more that haven't survived.
Yeah.
Because one thing to mention, you might think, we've got letters of Cicero from 1,000 years or more before this. How isn't it all well documented? Mm. Well, actually, if you go back beyond the sort of the higher Middle Ages, in a sense, it depends which historian you want to read or listen to. It's sort of incredible that anything survives in a way.
Yeah, yeah.
But William of Poitiers, who was actually a chaplain of the Conqueror, so he would have like sort of taken his confession and all sorts of things. Obviously, his history is absolutely biased. I mean, it's a hagiography, really, of William. But he wrote a gesta, the deeds of William.
It's as biased as Julius Caesar's own commentaries, basically.
Right, yes, basically, yeah, yeah, yeah. But then we've also got bits of the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, like I say, when he turns up. And then there's also, of course, the Bayeux Tapestry.
Propaganda.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
I think that's probably was commissioned by William's younger half-brother, Count Odo of Bayeux. What I wanted to do is sort of try and set the scene, because this is going to probably be a multi-parter about William and the conquest. It'd be a shame to just cram it all into
one. Can't do it short shrift.
Yeah, exactly. This is sort of a big one, a set piece thing, really, isn't it? So just to sort of set the scene of sort of the Normans a bit, 5-10 minutes on that. So I suppose you could say lots of histories sort of start with, it was a good place to start, Charlemagne.
Hmm.
Charlemagne was crowned in the year 800. He was already old by that point, in his 60s, towards the end of his life. But you can say there that you've got sort of the empire of Charlemagne, which breaks up almost straight away. Certainly by the age of his grandchildren, it's just a sort of a complete mess.
Yeah.
Or famously breaks into three for a while, East and West Francia and Lotharingia.
Because it gets divided up among the heirs, doesn't it? So you've got this giant empire. It doesn't just go to one guy. It goes to a piece to each. And it's like, okay, well, I mean, great, but why bother creating a giant empire that you're going to just splinter off anyway?
It does beg that question, doesn't it? Yeah. You think, like, so... Yeah, I guess
it's easy. What was the point?
It's easy in hindsight to say that sort of thing, but yeah, it's still perfectly true, isn't it? Yeah. It's still perfectly... Like, why would you... So...
Yeah.
Well, in the trajectory of things is that it gets more and more splintered, really. Mm. There's... It's more complicated than that. It does sort of, at various points, sort of... coagulate together again and then break up again, but
yeah.
One of the important things to mention is that you've got, in the end, very broadly speaking here, and people that know their stuff will say that's very low resolution, but West Francia is France.
Yeah.
East Francia is Germany.
Roughly speaking.
Right, very roughly speaking. So we talk about West Francia. The kings of West Francia, the kings of France, I suppose. Yeah. Now we're still talking the 9th century.
Mm-hmm.
8th, 9th, 10th century, we're talking here. And there was an area called Neustria. They called Neustria in West Francia,
mm-hmm.
which, again, broadly speaking, becomes Normandy, basically. So one of the things to say is that the Vikings...
are raiding these coasts, and they raid up the Seine and sack Paris at points. And I think it was a French king called Charles or something who was on the throne who... who's just like, look, I'll just give the Vikings like this land and they can defend it as a buffer zone, basically.
Yeah, no, that is basically exactly it. Yeah. Someone in the comments, you get this comment all the time, they say, you know, the word Viking is a verb,
means
not
raider,
a noun.
Yes.
It's like, yeah, I know, yeah. And yet it's convention for us to use it both ways, so get over it.
We're talking about Scandinavian raiders.
Yeah, everyone knows what we're talking about. Okay, well, let's just cut straight to Rollo. There's a King Rollo. Rollo the Walker is sometimes called.
Isn't this the guy who's supposed to be too big to ride horses?
I think that's one of the things that's said, that he's like some sort of giant.
Yeah.
Probably. Although Scandinavians can be massive guys,
they
can't they?
And the horses were not that big. You know, because everyone thinks modern horses are unusually large. Like even like, you know, a sort of high Middle Ages destrier is not very big, you know. And so going back to like, you know, 900 AD, it's entirely possible that there was a Viking too big to ride a horse. You know, it's totally possible.
I said it before in the last one, but quite a lot of the world's strongest men are Scandinavian types, or Northwest European.
Totally.
Just to quickly say on that, loads of things are bigger now, like the dairy cows that we have now. To someone in the 10th century, that
chickens
would be crazy. Yeah, chickens are massive.
Chickens, yeah. There was a breeding program in the 20th century to try and make it so that everyone could have a chicken. And so basically they bred chickens to inflate. Like chicken used to be like a rare delicacy, basically.
Yeah.
So, but and the thing is, it's such a, you know, it's an unusual name. You wouldn't make it up, right? Rollo the Walker, why? Because he's too big to get on horses. That sounds plausible to me. I don't think that's implausible at all.
Oh, it's not implausible, no. You know? No. One last thing just to say on that. It's even in the Marshall Plan after World War II, one example, the Americans shipped over loads and loads of pack mules and donkeys to places in sort of the Near East. Mm. And they couldn't believe how massive and strong these American donkeys were compared to their cruddy sort of Armenian donkeys or whatever. Watching a program about medieval food and that strawberries, just one tiny example, strawberries are sort of tiny little raspberry sized. We used to like massive fat strawberries.
Yeah.
Even apples, we used to massive, perfectly uniform apples.
Yeah. Whereas, they're little crab apples.
So anyway, Rollo. There is actually a cartoon from the early 80s, King Rollo, which is really nice and sweet. It's for little kids.
Right.
And I think it couldn't be more opposite to the real Rollo. The real Rollo is someone a bit more like Hardrada than anything else.
Yeah.
Just if you get in his way, he'll hack you to pieces.
Yeah.
Simple as that. Anyway, following in the footsteps of people like Lothbrok was sail down the Seine.
Mm-hmm.
Rouen is on the Seine,
mm-hmm.
Which becomes sort of one of the major cities in Normandy. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think Falaise is technically their capital, but sort of nowadays Rouen is considered the most important town in modern Normandy.
It becomes a sort of de facto centre city, doesn't it? Because of the accessibility of it.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. So they sailed, like Rollo sailed down the Seine to Paris and very, very, very nearly took it.
Mm.
That's a story that's happened more than once, actually, as well. He didn't quite take it, but was able to sort of set himself up. He wasn't turned back and defeated or anything.
No.
So what you've got there is an interesting relationship between the kings of France, for want of a better word. I think I've said in previous epochs, it's not really a king of France. They didn't style themselves the king of France until like the 11th century or later.
Well, even. They were just the king of the Franks, right?
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Like Rex Francorum.
Yeah.
King of the Franks, king of the Western Franks even. Mm. So the relationship between neither was strong enough or powerful enough to annihilate the other. So there's sort of a delicate balancing act between the kings of France. I'm just going to start calling them the kings of France, regardless of what I just said. they sort of have to rely on them. So what it seems is that in the, certainly in sort of the 9th and 10th, 11th century, West Francia would have been raided by all sorts of different peoples, and that the king of France, for want of a better expression, would have had like the Burgundians were their own thing.
Mm.
The rulers, the counts of Aquitaine, are their own thing.
We're still coming out of the sort of fall of the Western Roman Empire, where the Germanic tribes all just took up a piece and created their own kings. I've just finished a book on the Goths, actually. And I never did I think a people have been more hard done by history than the Goths. Like, they seem to be really noble people. And honourable and decent and concerned about justice. But, I mean, it was a pro-Goth book, I suppose. So that's the impression I got. The Franks didn't come out of it looking very good, to be honest.
Yeah.
But it's like patchworks of tribes, basically, that are forming into long-lasting kingdoms.
Yeah. So what it seems to have been, there was supposed to be some sort of central crown in Paris. What's the other town where they would often get in Rennes. I'm going to pronounce a lot of these French words poorly, so apologies. So, you know, the old paradigm that you would raise men when needed, when there's an enemy army or horde host on the horizon, you'd raise men, usually in the summer. That whole paradigm doesn't work anymore. It's falling apart. You need armed men all year round, in case something happens.
Yeah.
And the French crown couldn't really do that. It wasn't capable of doing that, really. It didn't wield that kind of authority. So what they would do is they'd say, okay, like the Count of Anjou, let's say, you have your own sort of small proto-army or your own a few hundred, few thousand retainers, armed retainers, and you keep that completely at your own expense and everything, but sort of on behalf of the central crown, and so we'll defend ourselves that way.
And you can see how the development of feudalism comes about out of this. If I've always got a body of like 1,000 armed men permanently attached to me, well, why shouldn't I be able to use them? They're my men.
Mm.
You know, of course I've got a right of feud. Mm-hmm. That guy over there took one of my castles. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go take it back, you know, anyway.
Yeah, just very quickly to say on the word feudalism, historians argue a lot over that, saying it was a concept that's much more like much later in sort of the 16th century, or wasn't even coined properly until the 19th century. Historians get their panties in a bunch about that word.
The way they behave.
And yet we all sort of know what it means still, don't we?
The way they behave as the sort of, they're miniature sovereigns. And this is one of the things that I think Machiavelli points out about the difference between France and the Ottoman Empire, in fact. You know, the Ottoman Empire, you just have to win one giant battle against the Sultan, then the entire thing is conquered. Whereas with France, you can't do that because it's lots of mini sovereigns who are bound together in a series of oath relationships with the king, you know, this is a great problem with what we're going to call the feudal structure, is that, well, what if one of your vassals starts getting really rich and can actually afford a really big army and it's bigger than yours, you know? De facto, you're the guy in charge, but, I mean, his army's twice as big as yours.
And he's richer. And he just commands more authority than you. Simple as that.
But,
yeah.
But the thing is, like, if the king, ultimately, the king's position, as, again, Machiavelli points out, a prince should have no other thought than war. Okay, well, you've got no other thought than war, because that's really the final calculation of who's in charge and who's setting the rules. And that guy's army is bigger and stronger than yours. Are you really the king? That's right. The question, you know? Yeah. And so, anyway.
Yeah. It's exactly as you say. You can delegate out this sort of large amount of power, really, to your dukes and counts and things. And there's loads of them as well.
Oh,
it's like a patchwork, just like the Count of Arc,
hundreds,
Count of Maine or something. But it's very difficult to rein that back in, if not impossible.
But yeah, it's like herding cats. You know, yeah. it's insufferable. And in some ways, you can see how the English had, during like the Hundred Years' War, the English had something of an advantage in just organization. You know, they had, you know, dukes and whatnot as well. But like, this seems to be better centralization of command in the English army compared to the way that the French army works. I mean, we'll talk about Agincourt at some point, but you can see it there where they can't even decide on who's in charge of the order of battle on the day. And it's like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
You know, this is an enemy army right there. You've got to figure this out, you know?
Yeah.
But this is the system has strengths and weaknesses, basically.
Yeah.
As Machiavelli points out, it's difficult to just actually conquer it, but it's also difficult to manage it. So good luck.
Mm. And so where the Norsemen or Danes are raiding everywhere, for want of a better word.
I mean, it literally is. We should get a map of it, but it's just all along the coasts of literally everything, in the Mediterranean.
As I was just about to say, in the Med and stuff. So the sort of northwest coast of France is absolutely not spared from that.
No.
So the thinking of the French monarchs was that, well, okay, if we let a Viking type sort of have his own domain in Neustria, hopefully he'll be able to defend against sort of the endless sea rovers coming from Scandinavia.
I mean, that's bloody optimistic. Because I'd be like, well, what stops them from being a launching pad for Viking invasions, which did happen, as I understand. So, you know...
Yeah. I mean, it seems like a reasonable calculation, and on some level it is, of course, but also sort of a flawed idea as well.
Yeah.
So Rollo, I mean, what are his dates? The first half of the 10th century, so it's like his reign is 911 to 928. That's sort of his dates. Not a fantastic amount is known about Rollo. He's more than just a name. You know how we talked about how Harold Harefoot is almost just a name.
Yeah.
No real details properly about him. Well, Rollo's a bit more than that, but not a fantastic amount more than that. And it's not long, you know, only a few generations. What is it? 3, 4, 5 generations before we get up to the age of William the Conqueror. So it's pretty quick. They say within 2 generations, they've stopped talking their Scandinavian dialects. They've stopped being godless heathens.
Mm-hmm.
They've stopped sea roving.
Mm-hmm.
And they've settled down, they're speaking a type of French, they're building in the sort of, in the Romanesque fashion, they're speaking, they're writing in Latin.
They've adopted cavalry.
Right.
That was, you know, one of the big things about the Normans. So as I understand it, the cavalry was first sort of, the French cavalry was first sort of instituted by Charles Martel to combat the Moors. And this is where the stirrup first becomes widespread in Europe, as I understand it. Correct me if I'm wrong. So they've had this, you know, like quite not even very long tradition of heavy cavalry, really. You know, we're only talking 100 years or so, 150 years. And then the Normans get the cavalry and they're like, oh, this is brilliant. You know, this is really good. We can be really, really aggressive really quickly all the time now. And so the Normans seem to, you know, really love having the heavy cavalry. It's like, brilliant. You know, it's quite terrifying. Norman cavalry is some of the most effective troops of the Middle Ages by far.
Oh yeah, definitely. Of course, famously, the Romans didn't have stirrups.
No.
There's different ways of doing it, of sort of planting yourself firmly on a horse.
Well, you had to hold them with your knees.
Yeah, or just the saddle you sit in. You're sort of wedged into it a bit in various ways. Anyway, but the stirrups are just it's better.
Yeah,
it's just better.
Well, they allow you to brace.
Do all sorts of things, can't you?
Yeah, with it. Yeah.
Do all sorts of things.
But the real trick with the stirrups is that it makes lances incredibly effective, because of course you can couch a lance, as in brace it on yourself, push your feet forward, and hold yourself in the stirrups as you collide with something, transferring a lot more force onto the target, which makes the Norman and, you know, the medieval cavalry charge just devastating. And there's a reason, like, for 500 years, the cavalry dominated the battlefield, absolutely dominated.
It's really interesting to note the ebb and flow of, for example, cavalry, how sort of popular it is in different places, different cultures at different times, and it ebbs and wanes.
Mm.
The same with archery at different points. Archers are considered... So, we may or may not talk about the actual Battle of Hastings in this one, but just to say something about that is that on the Anglo-Saxon side, on our side, we had very, very little archery. And it seems that just the cultural thinking at the time was that cavemen used bows and arrows.
Cowards.
Something like that. Yeah, there's something.
The Spartans despised them, you know.
Yeah, right.
For exactly that reason.
But then the English, of course, in the later Middle Ages, are famed for the longbow.
Mm.
So you can just see that its popularity goes up and down over time.
Yeah, yeah.
The Normans happily use loads of arrows. There's like arrow showers from the Norman side in the Battle of Hastings.
Yeah.
So it's just interesting. And the Normans loved their cavalry.
Yes.
Absolutely loved their cavalry. Again, the Anglo-Saxons quite often would turn up to a battlefield on horse and then dismount.
Yeah, deliberately. Yeah. But, like, I mean, were the Anglo-Saxons using stirrups?
I don't know. I don't think so, but I don't know about that.
Yeah, I don't know either. But the fact that it's not mentioned anywhere makes me think they're not, you know?
I'm trying to think of the Bayeux Tapestry, because a historian would just say, take a look at the Bayeux Tapestry.
Yeah, but...
And I can't remember if it shows stirrups or not.
But even if it does, like, that's, you know, okay, so the artists or the women who are stitching it, they put stirrups on everything, fine. But that doesn't, you know, like if you ask someone now to like ask a bunch of modern artists, right, draw, you know, tanks or something. They might draw Russian tanks with Western military innovations on them, you know. And so future historians will be like, yeah, well, there's Russian tanks in this picture. So yeah, but the artist didn't know anything about it, really, you know. You can't be sure, you know.
No, that's a good point.
I've never heard it mentioned in any source that the Anglo-Saxons had stirrups.
Yeah, if I had to put money on it right this second without checking, I'd say no.
Yeah, same.
Okay, so let's get into William's life. So his father...
Sorry, when was he born? What was the year?
Like, what is it off the top of my head? 1028, is it?
Right.
That's an interest. We don't know the exact year.
But roughly early 11th century.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
1028. 1027, 28, we think he was born. So actually his life is split quite neatly into sort of 20-year blocks. Mm. So he lives to be about 60-odd. Mm. So to mention, William the Conqueror's father, well, his grandfather was Duke of Normandy. And he dies and leaves it to his eldest son, a William. Mm. Our William the Conqueror, his father is Robert.
Right.
So William inherits.
The different son then.
Right. And so there's these two boys, a William and the younger brother, Robert. William inherits and he's very quickly killed by his brother.
Well, he
dies and we think almost certainly was killed or usurped
I'm sure nothing bad ever happened in Normandy. Yeah. What are you talking about?
His own younger brother, Robert.
Yeah.
Right away, you can see they're all called things like Richard, William, Robert, things like that. Mm. Not Scandinavian names like Rollo.
Yeah, they integrate very, very quickly, don't they? Yeah. Weird how quickly they integrate.
Yeah, right. It's very deliberate and very fast. Yeah.
But it shows you the power of French culture, though, right?
Yeah.
Like, the French culture must have been very influential.
Oh, no question.
But then compared to where have they come from? Some Scandinavian village with, you know, wooden huts. And the French have got giant stone cathedrals and, you know, an ancient tradition and, you know, Catholicism, connections to Rome and all the, you know, we're the inheritors of the Roman Empire. You know, you can see how this would be like, oh, wow, okay, yeah, we'll do things the way you guys do things. This is amazing. Those are good-looking horses, you know, like, you can see why.
Yeah. I mean, the Burgundian court, or just French chivalry, it's a difficult, problematic word, but French culture, let's just say.
Yeah.
Very, very powerful and dominant all through the Middle Ages and the Dark Ages. Well, right, yeah.
You know.
Unfortunately.
Much
to my chagrin.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, William the Conqueror's father, Duke Robert.
Yeah.
He marries a woman called Herleva of Falaise. Who was not noble. Sorry, he doesn't marry her. He just beds her. We don't know a fantastic amount about her because the sources say different things. Some say her family just sort of worked at the court and she just caught his eye at some point.
Mm.
Others say that he was riding through Falaise at some point and she caught his eye. Some say her father was a type of undertaker. Some say her father was a type of tanner.
Mm. That's the one I've heard.
Right, that's probably the main one. And anyone who doesn't know that tanning is really gross.
It's necessary, though.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
God, so, yes. So what you do is you collect as much urine as you can and bathe leather in it. And then you beat it and dry it and whatnot. And it's so very disgusting. But then you end up with something hard and usable as a strong material.
And you really need leather.
You need it for everything.
Yeah, for loads of things. You need tanners. They're really important.
Yeah.
But it's really, really dirty and smelly. Really smelly.
Yeah.
And obviously... sort of looked down upon a bit, although being really important, you know.
A lot of important things are looked down on for some reason.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll pay nurses a pittance, but footballers get millions.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Well, it doesn't make sense. Yeah. It's not fair.
But it's like rubbish collecting. It's like, sorry, I remember just as a kid having, you know, like friends of mine had this attitude of like, oh, they're the bin men. It's like, yeah, but I don't want to take the rubbish anywhere. Like, they're doing me a really good service here. I really appreciate it, you know.
And if they stop...
Yeah.
It's terrible.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, exactly. So it's just like, I don't know why we look down on these people. I'm genuinely glad they do what they do. Same with the tanners, I'm sure, you know.
Quite often, or nearly always, even in the modern world, in sort of third world countries where they still do this sort of thing by hand, tanning things will be deliberately placed outside the city walls or as far away from the nice bits of town as possible.
Because it's basically a sewage works.
Yeah.
You know, you don't actually want that near you.
Yeah.
I mean, not just for the smell, the hygiene as well.
You're right. So for the Duke to marry the daughter of a tanner, probably, maybe, it's really lowly.
Same thing as Margaret Thatcher, though, isn't it? You know, she'll never have that aristocratic background, and so there's always going to be a glass ceiling there from the peasantry. But she must have been a babe, otherwise she wouldn't have done it.
I think she was some sort of smoke show.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.